The BJP, popularly known as Saffron Party, is said to have recruited thousands of Muslim leaders and activists from different class-based groups to help it with campaigning. They are going all out to win over Muslim voters, especially those categorized as the Pasmanda. A BJP source says there are 27 assembly segments in Gujarat where Muslim voters have a significant impact on the election outcome. The party, therefore, has concentrated its strategy on these assembly segments by using Muslim community leaders and workers to conduct door-to-door campaigning in Muslim-dominated neighborhoods. A party source says their task is to inform Muslim voters about the welfare schemes launched for them by the BJP government. The Muslim leaders are also attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party, which has so far been seen as anti-Muslim and hate-monger.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Razvi. He's a political commentator from London. First of all, welcome to the programme, Mr. Razvi. Now, after the big victory in the assembly elections, the BJP has now intensified its attempts with the civic elections. So what is the importance of this election for BJP and other parties?
BJP has been in power for the last 8 years, and they're hoping to sort of continue in power for the next 4 years when the general elections come up shortly. The situation is what you've got to look at is really well documented in what is called the Gujarat Files, anatomy of a cover-up by a famous Muslim journalist in India called Rana Ayub. And she really sort of shows how Narendra Modi and Amit Shah ascended in power and their journey from Gujarat to New Delhi. What they did back in the early 2000s, when there were huge massacre and program of Muslim killing in Gujarat. So they've used that as a template from Gujarat to really occupy the power, the central power in New Delhi. And they're using that, as I said, as a template to motivate the Hindu majority on a very sort of religious basis. And their former two victories have been basically, essentially based on that particular approach of dividing the Indian population into Hindus and Muslims.
So, Mr. Razvi, while the BJP government tries to woo Pasmanda or backward Muslims by welfare schemes, the Muslim leaders are attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party itself. So what are the roots of these doubts amongst the Muslim community?
Well, what you've got to look at is that Pasmanda Muslims, as I said, Indian society is a very caste-ridden society. You have the ruling elite, which comes from the Brahmin caste, which is perhaps 1%, 2% of the Hindu population. Then you've got many stratas of Hindus who are lower caste or what are known as Harijans, the untouchables. Then you have what is, interestingly called the other backward class or classes, in which Pasmanda Muslims are also included, because they are, by definition, not in the Hindu caste system because they're Muslims, but also because they have been impoverished, poor, and sort of in occupations which are seen as to be demeaning for ordinary other people. So effectively, 51, for example, in a state like Bihar, which is in the eastern part of India, over 50% of the population is deemed to be other backward classes, which includes Hindus and Muslims. So it's a sort of a very complex political voting bank structure, if you like. In the past, the Congress Party, which used to rule India for the good 30 years after the partition in 1947, also relied on the Muslim vote. So what the BJP is now trying to do, I suspect, is trying to woo these Pasmanda Muslims from the poor and the lower classes to vote for them, because they've been offering them certain incentives and other benefits, which could sort of give BJP that leverage in getting the Muslim vote as well from these particularly deprived classes in India.
Mr. Razvi, like you said, in the 1990s, we saw the rise of several social movements that gave voice to and a new direction to abolish class or caste-based hierarchy in the Muslim society. So the question is, why have these movements become faint and silent today?
It's an interesting question. Effectively, in Islam or in Muslims, there is supposed to be no caste system. However, there are elitist Muslims, well-off Muslims, educated Muslims up and down the country from north to the south, east to the west. As you know, India is a huge country with a population of about 1.4 billion. So in that, you would have some wealthy Muslims. What has happened, sadly, if you like, is that some of the very wealthy Muslims themselves, whether they live in New Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, Calcutta, they have tended to actually turn a blind eye to their own Muslim brethren at times.
Before we let you go, sir, the BJP government has decided to enter the Muslim question not from the top but from the bottom through Dalits, OBCs and tribals. So what are the effects of this strategy on the unity of Muslims in India?
Well, that's a very difficult question. One would have to really see what happens at the election, but I'm sure they will make some inroad into the poor community because, as I said, the other backward classes, the OBCs, if you like, and Muslims, some of the poor Muslims fall in that category. Therefore, the incentives and the sweetness that are being offered to poorer Muslims, if you like, will sway some of them to vote. But I think the strategy in the medium to long term, but in the short term, it may be effective. But I think medium to long term, the Muslim political elite will realize that it's in their interest also to be working together with their less well-off Muslim brethren, Muslim community, so that they are not swayed by BJP at this moment.
There you have it, Mr. Shabir Razvi, a political commentator from London. It's always good to have you with us, Mr. Razvi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Relatively orderly posted, Rajnath Singh reaches out to Muslims, says BJP ready to apologize for past mistakes. Pallavi Ghosh says, will Muslims vote for the BJP in 2024 as BJP reaches out to them?
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In early October, Bangladesh suffered from a grid failure that triggered a blackout across 75 to 80% of the country. This latest development is a mere indicator of the looming power crisis in Bangladesh, where long power cuts and load shedding have become common occurrences. The intermittent electricity supply has impacted key export industries, which are crucial for bringing in much-needed foreign exchange. This crisis also threatens to push Bangladesh into a cycle where it will be unable to secure enough energy imports due to a shortage of foreign reserves, having long-standing strategic implications with its energy partners.
A combination of global and domestic factors has led Bangladesh to the present crisis. Close to 85% of the nation's electricity is generated using fossil fuel like natural gas and oil, with the former being the primary source. An exponential rise in oil and gas prices due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the decision by the OPEC Plus to reduce oil output, and the European Union's sanctions on the Russian energy sector has resulted in surging inflation and unsustainable energy import bills. Thus, Bangladesh has also been compelled to stop gas purchases and shut down its several diesel-run power plants. Dhaka's scant attention to renewable energy and policies like capacity payments has exacerbated the energy crisis there. Until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest-growing economy in the region. A core part of its success has been the ready-made garments industry, which makes up more than 10% of its GDP and employs around 4.5 million people. Today, Bangladesh is the world's second-largest garments exporter, and the RMG sector accounts for 84% of its exports, playing a crucial role in the country's foreign reserves. However, the current crisis has slowed down the industry, with many factories reporting a fall-off in production by 50%. Daily power outages lasting around 3 hours on average have been one of the main contributors to this trend.
For Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. Each of its key energy partners comes with a caveat. With Russia, it's the possibility of further attracting Western pressure, unpredictability, and rising costs of doing business. Reliance on China raises questions about reliability and unsustainable debt, and also disrupts the brewing relationship with India and the US. Undoubtedly, the US comes with expertise and financial capabilities, but lacks commitments, and therefore is not yet capable of countering Russian and Chinese cooperation with Dhaka. Finally, despite technical and financial limitations, India comes with the potential for energy connectivity and trade.
Dhaka faces an uphill task of securing additional gas supplies, rapidly diversifying electricity mix to meet its green energy pledges, and continuing the dynamic economic growth. Shift towards prioritizing long-term energy security requires a careful balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another. China and Russia have traditionally been vital partners for Bangladesh's energy sector. Today, 90% of the energy projects in Bangladesh's pipeline are funded by China. On the other hand, Moscow has helped Bangladesh with gas exploration and drilling. It has also extended nuclear cooperation by building Bangladesh's first power plant. China and Russia's increasing energy cooperation with Dhaka have compelled the United States to step up its cooperation to be a credible energy partner for Dhaka and counter its reliance on Russia and China. Acknowledging the growing extra-regional footprint in Bangladesh, India is also ramping up its energy cooperation with Dhaka. Revitalized dialogue channels within Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, and Nepal for regional cooperation in energy can provide Bangladesh access to cheap and clean energy from Nepal and Bhutan as well. This cooperation allows Bangladesh a long-term solution for its growing power demand and could help reduce its reliance on fossil fuels by tapping the vast hydropower potential of the neighboring Himalayan nations.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed. He's a director for Center for Muslim Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, for Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. How can Dhaka use the situation, balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another?
Yeah, I think the issue that Bangladesh has is a short-term and a long-term one. And, you know, that in the short term, like in other parts of the world, the energy crisis is going to be very difficult and challenging, as you say, to deal with. Because of the increase in prices, the capacity of Bangladesh has been really the fact that they don't have enough reserves to pay for the extra cost rise that's taken place around the world. And they've been dependent on mainly Russia and China for their gas and Qatar for their needs, both petrol and also the gas mainly. And this has meant that really the West is sanctioning those two countries, and therefore the supply has decreased, demand is still there, and prices have gone up. So this is a difficult environment for them to navigate. It means they have to look elsewhere as well.
Mr. Mohammed, until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest growing economy in the region. What are the main effects of Bangladesh energy crises can have on the regional economy?
Well, obviously, the demand for energy is still the same and increasing, but the supply of energy has been reduced, and that means that the cost has also increased. And for countries with a fragile sort of balance of reserves in their accounts, it means that they're having to pay a lot more to buy the energy that they need for the country, and that means their reserves are plummeting, which affects their whole economic situation. And secondly, of course, if you're having load shedding and power cuts during the day a number of times, then the capacity of business and local people to continue their economic life is affected. So naturally, growth will be affected.
Mr. Mohammed, for Bangladesh, regional cooperation in energy with Bhutan, India and Nepal can provide it with access to cheap and clean energy. So what factors prevent Dhaka from this cooperation?
Obviously, India is also under pressure not to trade with Russia. So trading and working with India, which leads this regional cooperation effort, also means getting close to Russia. But Bangladesh itself is a major has China as its major trading partner, and particularly in the energy sector. And they have debts to China, loans to China. And of course, China and India are economic rivals, but also political enemies over the Kashmir issue and many, many other issues. India is a part of the alliance with the West, AUKUS, and other alliances against China.
Last but not least, Mr. Mohammed, with the winter and a cap on Russian fuel imports approaching, European buyers will look to stock up even more LNG. So what are the consequences of this European action for developing countries like Bangladesh, and what can these countries do to get out of this condition?
Well, obviously, the sanctions will remain on Russia and on China as well. Iran is also sanctioned, so you know that's taken out of the market. There's the Europeans are looking for alternative sources for their own supplies, including the United States, which has a lot of LNG, and Qatar, which also does. But that will take a long time, a couple of years to be able to meet the demand from Europe. So not only the developing world, but European countries are also going to suffer in this energy crisis, because supply is going to be restricted and demand is still the same and increasing.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Mohammed for being on the program. He's a director at the Center for Muslim Affairs in Manchester. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Avex Chemicals India tweeted, "Bangladesh needs political willpower because there's high corruption. That's why the country is going through an economic crisis. Bangladesh needs economic reforms if they want to save the nation. India really cares about Bangladesh. hope Prime Minister Hasina Ji does the same. Lalit Singh Mehta writes, Bangladesh raised petrol prices by 52% in one day. 52% rise. People on streets protesting. Bangladesh going to IMF with begging bowl as economic crisis mounts. Shops locked after 8 p.m. to save energy. 13-hour daily power cut. All expert fans of Bangladesh economy suddenly silent. Sohail Khan says, half a worth reading article. Bangladesh and India grew in past two decades, while Pakistan economy didn't grow, mainly due to war on terror, power sector crisis, and poor policies. Now, as Pakistan has controlled terrorism, inshallah, Pakistan will grow and will compete neighbors in 2040.
And that was our episode about the dual policy of the Indian government towards religious minorities and the Bangladesh power crisis and its strategic implications. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
کسالت و بیحالی که خدا ضد حال داره میزنه موقته، برای اینکه عجب نگیرتت، برای اینکه دچار عجب نشی.
Sometimes the temporary tiredness and feeling downcast is because Allah wants you not to be proud and arrogant. This is to break your sense of selfishness inside. There is a beautiful story by Maulavi in his book Masnavi. He narrates, once the Satan went to a cruel king to wake him up for the early morning prayer. Since cruel king knew that the Satan had a trick in his mind, he asked him for the main reason of waking up.
شیطان آخرش گفت بیدارت کردم برای اینکه اگر بیدار نمیشدی خواب میموندی.
In his answer, the Satan said, I waked you up because if you were to wake up late and then sigh because of the missed chance of prayer, that sigh of yours had more value than your very prayer. From this story, we understand that our sigh of heart, which is rooted in our repentance, is sometimes better than our practical deeds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Energy analysts are saying the implementation of an oil price cap that the United States and its allies, the Group of Seven, have agreed to place on Russian oil imports may initially cause a sharp decrease in Russian oil in the market and, as a result, a jump in the oil price. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. English website of Al Jazeera television network has covered this story. The Kremlin has rejected a $60 per barrel price cap that the United States and its allies in the European Union and the Group of Seven industrialized nations have agreed to place on Russian oil imports as an attempt to starve Moscow's ongoing campaign in Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told news agencies on Saturday, 3rd of December, "We will not accept this price cap. The bloc and the Group of Seven industrialized nations that includes the United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, Canada, United States, France and Japan announced the agreement alongside Australia on Friday, 2nd of December, saying they would start imposing the price ceiling on Monday, 5th of December. The European Union is also slated to start enforcing an oil embargo of its own on Russian crude oil deliveries that would ban seaborne shipments, which reportedly account for 2/3 of the imports of the European Union. The G7 group claimed by employing the cap it was delivering on its vow to prevent Russia from profiting from its special operation in Ukraine, to support stability in global energy markets, and to minimize negative economic spillovers of Russia's operation. Russia's conflict in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying it was aimed at defending pro-Russian population in eastern Ukraine, particularly in the regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. Ever since the beginning of the operation, Kiev's Western allies, led by the United States of America, have been pumping Ukraine full of advanced weapons and snapping sanctions on Russia, steps that Moscow says will only prolong the hostilities. The White House has described the price cap deal as welcome news, claiming the agreement would help limit Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to fund its special operation in Ukraine. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky downplayed the measure, saying it would not do enough to keep the Russian campaign in check. Zelensky said, "Now the world discussion on price caps, that is, on limiting the export price of Russian oil, has ended, unfortunately, with no serious decisions. Because you wouldn't call it a serious decision to set such a limit for Russian prices, which is quite comfortable for the budget of Russia." Andrei Yermak, head of Zelensky's administration, also claimed the price cap should have been set at $30 a barrel to destroy Russia's economy. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Russian embassy in the United States says Kremlin will keep looking for buyers for its oil, despite a dangerous attempt by the West to introduce a $60 price cap on Russian oil, amid a pressure campaign against Moscow over its conflict in Ukraine. From 5th of December onwards, Western shipping and insurance companies would be prohibited from handling Russian oil sold above the price cap. In Washington, Russia's embassy said the latest attempt was part of a larger plan for reshaping the free market principles. The Russian embassy said in a statement, "Russia's oil would still continue to be in demand." It said steps like these will inevitably result in increasing uncertainty and imposing higher costs for raw materials consumers. The statement added, "Regardless of the current flirtations with a dangerous and illegitimate instrument, we are confident that Russian oil will continue to be in demand." U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen claimed, "With Russia's economy already contracting and its budget increasingly stretched thin, the price cap will immediately cut into Putin's most important source of revenue." Senior Russian politician Leonid Slutsky said Russia can partially annul the restriction by moving to sell its oil in other markets such as India and Russia. Citing an oil ministry source, Reuters news agency reported on Friday, 2nd of December, that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchase, provided that Western services are not used. On 29th of November, Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured that he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in energy cooperation. China and India are currently the largest single buyers of Russian crude oil. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more. The cap on the price of Russian oil transported by sea is designed to affect the country's exports worldwide, in addition to the EU-wide embargo on Russian crude oil, which comes into force on 5th of December. Countries not party to the deal will only be able to access services such as insurance, shipping and brokerage if they trade Russian oil at or below the $60 price cap. As the countries involved in the deal, such as the United Kingdom, The belief is that most countries and businesses will be forced to comply. In a statement, G7 countries claimed they hoped the deal would also work to reduce the price of oil for low to middle income countries, who have felt the impact of the conflict in Ukraine disproportionately. On Thursday, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow had dismissed the impact of the price cap and would negotiate with its partners directly. The G7 agreement came after much debate with Poland, party to the deal as an EU member and one of Ukraine's closest allies, which had pushed for a price cap to be as low as $30 a barrel, arguing that to squeeze Russia's economy, the price cap should be lower. But G7 countries concluded that the price of $60 a barrel would prevent a rise in global oil prices that would put strain on countries already experiencing high inflation. Russian officials suggested Western economies may not be so lucky. Mikhail Ulyanov, Russia's representative to the international organizations in Vienna, said, "Starting from this year, Europe will live without Russian oil. Moscow has already made it clear that it will not supply oil to those countries who support the anti-market price cap." US President Joe Biden said on Thursday, 1st of December, that he would talk to Russia's President Vladimir Putin about the conflict only if he could see an indication that Russia was prepared to pull out of Ukraine. Joe Biden said, "There's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin should pull out of Ukraine. I'm prepared to speak with Vladimir Putin if in fact there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war." Reacting to Joe Biden's comments, Vladimir Putin said he would enter into talks only if Ukraine recognizes Russia's annexation of the southern and eastern areas of Ukraine.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Today in our studio, we have with us a very special guest, an educationalist, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you
for
inviting
me. Welcome.
Here. It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
It's an honor to be with you, sir. Well, Dr. Alavi, we have been discussing about the self-confidence in children, and you helped us with the fact that what are the signs that could tell parents that does their child have enough self-confidence or is it lowered? Now you were telling us about the things that lower the self-confidence in a child.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. We started our discussion with the self-confidence, what is self-confidence, and what are the signs of a kid or a child who has enough self-confidence. Now, slowly, we moved to the factors that actually cause lack of self-confidence or cause self-confidence to be weakened, to get weakened. We talked about the sense of feeling unworthy. That is, the kid automatically, based on his intellect, understand that he actually done something in a lower level in comparison with others or with the other kids at the same age of him.
Yeah.
So he finds and he understands that, okay, there is a poor a function that actually brings a sort of, let's say, weak judgment of the parents or the guardians. So we as parents have to be very careful in case our kids are doing something poorly. We should not actually object them or, let's say, contact them very harshly.
Yeah.
So we have to be very cautious in these issues. So you might say it's very difficult to see that every other kid is improving and my own kid is actually lagging behind in some areas. So we have to know that the abilities and capabilities of people are different.
Yeah.
We know that there are some famous scientists that, I mean, they have been even dismissed from the school, but they have done great works.
But they have been scientists.
I don't know if it is good or not to mention about Einstein, that he was even dismissed from the school sometime. And he had no place to go except the graveyard where her mother was buried there.
Yeah.
You see? So in case we want
we also have Rabindranath Tagore in India who wrote the national anthem, and he was failed more than 10 times in his 10th class.
Definitely.
So
we have to know, I mean, as parents, about the differences between different age groups and even in the same age group, we have to know about the capabilities and abilities of different kids and children.
Yeah.
And we should not judge all of them based on one criteria. Let's see, for example, in case he's doing poorly in, let's say, sports, to see, or for example, in football, let's check if he's exactly the same way in this, in, let's say, tennis or other, let's say, branches of sports or no.
Yeah.
So these are the questions that we have to actually have in mind and be careful not to act in a way that the kid understand what is in our mind. And he, as I said earlier, he definitely understand what is going on in our minds. I mean, he or she.
All right. So even you're trying to tell us over here that even if you as parents feel like I'm done with my child, I have no hope left now, or you're not able to understand about his next capabilities, you should not show that hopelessness to your children.
Definitely.
Because they understand. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are talking about self-confidence. So, Dr. Alavi, you were helping us with the things that actually lower the self-confidence in children.
Let's move to second element or factor that I want to mention on what weakens the self-confidence in children is that increased functional pressure. We in our societies, we see usually on the kids or children of 10 and over, usually teachers, parents are expecting even more, let's say, actions or let's say innovations from the kids.
Yeah.
So they try to start comparisons with others. Let's see, I mean, the other kid who is only 12 years old or 2 years younger than you is doing blah, blah, and you are still lagging behind in this single case. As I said earlier, we have to be careful.
Or sometimes there's the reverse case.
Mm-hmm.
Parents actually compare, he's younger than you and he's doing more than you.
Yeah, exactly. The same way, I think this is the same case. Because, I mean, the kid is 14 years old, but, I mean, the subject that he's being compared to is 12 years old, right?
Yeah.
So they said, okay, he's younger than you and he's doing too much thing and you are still lagging behind in this issue. So we have to be, as I said earlier, in comparisons, we have to be very cautious. We have to have too many elements in our minds. Okay, sometimes even you do not compare. You said, okay, you do not compare with any kid as his own or her own age, but you say, okay, this book has been written for a student of, let's say, 12 years old. What's wrong with you that you cannot understand and you can analyze and you can learn whatever is in this book? So actually you're making a comparison with a higher group of students who are, for example, studying. I mean, for a group of students who have 12-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So we have to be cautious. These kind of, let's say, comparisons or analysis, analogies actually destroy the personality of the kid. So on the other hand, we should not, exaggerate on giving too much personification to the student or to the subject to ruin him from the other side. Okay, it's okay. You cannot learn it. It's your right. No problem. The book is, useless. We have to be careful. We have to find some other way to make him interested on that subject or to make him understand that.
Is very, very important that you, at the same time, you're not comparing and at the same time, you are not telling him that this book or other thing that he's not capable of.
You're not
is
blaming
useless.
The student.
You're
nor
balancing,
the,
basically.
Yeah,
things.
Exactly. So, yes, it's true that, for example, maybe the subject was not supposed to start here. So, since last year you had some problem, let's say, in going to school in some certain days, I think this refers to that. I think we have to compensate for that. So, we have to, let's say, take some tuitions or, find some other way to learn this. I think your cousin can learn you, can teach you this part of the book even better than me because I am not that, professional teacher to teach you or to learn you this part of the lesson or this part of, story, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So these pressures, as I said, usually increase in the ages of 10 and above. So we as parents, again, we have to be careful. If it is going to start to be damaged and destroyed, I think it will affect the life of the kid in the future.
Yeah, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are discussing about self-confidence and how we can boost that in children. Well, before we can talk about how we can boost it, Dr. Alavi has helped us a lot to know about how we actually destroy it unconsciously. Dr. Alavi, before going to the break, you told us that it's very, very necessary for parents to create a balance rather than comparing your children. You can introduce a role model. You can tell them different ways how to learn, but not compare.
Yeah, we have been saying that we are going to understand what elements actually strengthen the self-confidence. But since sometimes تعرف الأشداد بعض ضادها, that is, sometimes some issues are we can get some familiarity with some concepts when we know their opposite side. So we started to learn first what actually decreases the self-confidence first. Then, inshallah, we'll focus on, inshallah.
Yeah, doctors, before curing a disease, try to go back to its causes, what caused this disease, basically.
Definitely. And then, inshallah, we shall focus on the treatment and whatever strengthens the self-confidence.
Yeah.
The next point that I wanted to mention, which is just somehow related to the first two, that is to the feeling unworthy, and second, and the pressure of the increased functional pressure is the understanding of the dissatisfaction of the parents. When parents actually, as I said earlier, will show their pressure on the kid and their subjects.
And the child will feel like
the
I
child
have
now comes
you.
To feel it because he will show a sort of change in the behavior of the teacher or the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I told you earlier, the kids or subjects or children, our sons, our daughters, are very smart. We should not actually underestimate them.
Yeah.
They are really smart. Yeah, I mean, I have many stories about the smartness of the kids in these ages, but since the time actually does not allow us to even focus on those issues, I think I have to ignore and skip those stories. Some of these stories might even change our mindset about what, let's say, power our kids even have at the time of breastfeeding, you see? So we said that at this time, they understand the dissatisfaction of the parents from even their facial expressions.
All right.
You see? Then it is directly or indirectly, actually, it affects them in their own souls and in their own spirits. So it causes them to not to accept any risk to enter any, let's say, issue or event. So they'll try to make too many excuses in order to an action. While they are going to draw a painting, I mean, if you ask them, for example, to draw a painting, they might ask too many questions in order to, just to escape from that painting itself. Or when you want them to, work on something, since he thinks that there is a possibility of him to be humiliated or to find another, let's say, facial expression from your side, mm-hmm. he or she will try to escape it and leave it for a later time, that even those times will never come.
Yeah.
You see? This satisfaction, we have to be careful. Even we cannot tell lies with our facial expressions. So
exactly.
What is the solution? What should we do? We should really believe that if our kid is poor in one single aspect, it does not necessarily mean that he is poor in all different
all other aspects.
Areas. So this is something quite clear, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gifted us these abilities. And
yeah.
For example, he has gifted you, for example, the power in math. And he has, for example, inspired me in learning literature well and, writing poems, right?
Yeah.
You see, so our abilities differ. So we have to know that this this kid has some certain abilities, and we have to focus on those abilities and find and have the, the cleverness and smartness of finding those areas of his expertise and the area of his talent.
Yeah.
So this is what parents have to do with consulting with different counselors.
True. I remember a mother who went to a parent-teacher meeting with the hope that my child knows nothing. But after coming out of the parent-teacher meeting, she said, I never knew my son is, he has got different talents. Like in school, in that meeting, they were told that if your child is lacking in mathematics, just check out his abilities in drawing or painting or other things. And that way the mother realized, oh, wow, my son is much more talented than I
Definitely.
Ever thought about him. So that's how we actually, we ignore some fields, or maybe we never actually take them into consideration. Thank you so much, Dr. Alavi, for
You're
being
welcome,
with
sister.
Us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.